agriculture, they say, accounts for too much greenhouse gas and must be reformed. This leads us to ask, who is going to pay to clean up farming's bad gas?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 632nd edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Cannes who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hello.
Producer Carol Stafford.
Hello, everyone.
And Parmalee Taff is out sick today. But we are here. Folks, agriculture, they say, accounts for 14% of our annual greenhouse gas emissions. Land use change, such as the slash-and-burn agriculture often practiced in developing nations, contributes another 19% of the emissions. Enough is enough already. It's time to clean up farming's bad gas. But wait. How can we reform a business that provides half the world's people with cash income and which provides daily bread to every single one of us? How can we reform the goose that laid the golden egg? Here to help us find an answer today, we have Larry Matlack. And Larry is with the, he's the president of the American Agriculture Institute. Larry, welcome to the Food Chain.
Yes, thank you.
Good to have you aboard. Tell us about the American Agriculture Movement.
Yes. Well, the American Agriculture Movement is a farm advocacy group, of course, that's been around for more than 30 years now, primarily working on sustainable family farm practices and trying to keep the family farm as it's been over the years because it's the most productive and it does the best job of protecting the environment.
Well, we always ask, Larry, who pays the way? So who pays your way?
You mean the food producers?
Who pays the way for the American Agriculture Movement?
Oh, the American Agriculture Movement, of course, is a membership organization and a volunteer organization. We don't even have paid staff or employees. Everything is volunteer in our organization because we're working for the farmers that we represent.
Good enough. Waiting for my, I think I might have my next guest here, but maybe not. So we'll go to the big question. Do you think that we have global warming? And if so, is it caused by man?
Well, of course, that's a little above my pay grade.
Uh-huh.
I would say that...
whose pay grade is it not above? It gets right down to it.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. But in life in general, if we follow what the majority of the experts who spend their lives studying whatever field it is, if we follow their advice, we're right far more than we're wrong. And the majority of the experts say that climate change is real and that it is being caused by CO2, that man is... making that worse and worse, and that man can make that better. And so, you know, I find it hard as a layman without knowledge in the field to argue with that. That doesn't mean they're right, but like I say, history proves that most of the time, those in the field who work at it every day are right.
Okay, good enough. Let's go to Gerald Nelson, who is Dr. Gerald Nelson, who's a senior research fellow with the International Food Policy Research Institute. Dr. Jerry, welcome aboard.
Oh, glad to be here, Michael. Sorry about the bad connection.
Well, sometimes that happens in the world, and we persevered, and we have you.
Eventually, technology does work.
That's
right.
International Food Policy Research Institute. What on earth is that?
That's a horrible name. It's
it's a mouthful name, right?
It is, and it's part of an organization that also has a mouthful of a name, that Consultative Group on International Agricultural Research.
Uh-huh.
But it would help. The way to think about this is that we're part of the set of institutions that got the Green Revolution going about 30 years ago.
Spearheaded by Norman Borlaug, right?
Norman Borlaug had an important role to play on the wheat side of the story, mm-hmm. and rice was the other major part of the Green Revolution story that came out of the International Rice Research Institute at, in the Philippines.
So tell us a little bit, before we go on, exactly what you mean by the Green Revolution. What did Norman Borlaug do to wheat?
Yeah, well, he did a very important thing, I have to say. And what he basically did was to take what we already knew about sort of the science of plant genetics and had applied in the developed world, you know, the United States and Europe and Japan, and figured out how to do it in the developing world, to focus on crops that were important in the developing world, in particular rice and wheat, which are the two, biggies
mm-hmm.
of
staples.
Staple food crops around the world and particularly in the developing world. And he also... So the outcome of this research was that you got crop varieties that you could grow in countries like India and Mexico that had incredible responses to nitrogen fertilizer in particular. And at the same time, nitrogen fertilizer prices had come down after the war. So all of a sudden, farmers were able to plant these crops and in 1 year see doubling or tripling of yields. There was a situation in India where... there's a long story behind this, and it's kind of a fun story, but farmers ended up with so much grain between 1 year and the next that the marketing system just couldn't handle it. It was stacked all over the place. Needless to say, there are millions of people in South Asia in particular that are alive today that wouldn't be if it hadn't been for the Green Revolution.
And probably allowed for a significant bloom in the population of the world too, right? Boom.
No, the thing about population growth, it's really not driven by how much food you have to eat. It's driven by, for example, what you think your children can accomplish for you and those things like, in the developing world, in the poorest parts of the developing world, the children are necessary to support the adults in their old age. Now, in my part of the world and your part of the world, we consider kids to be an expense rather than a support in our old age, and some of them actually boomerang back home.
Until we start thinking about Social Security.
Exactly. And so as countries develop, they begin to think about putting in place Social Security systems. Kids are no longer necessary to work on the farms. They're not part of the productive part of the household. Instead, we spend money on them for education and schools and things like that. And so all of a sudden, they become expensive. And then we think about ways to reduce the number of kids that we have.
Mm-hmm. So there you are. So that's why the population blooms in the developing parts of the world and not so much in the developed parts of the world. Let me ask you this. We always ask our guests who pays the way. So who pays the way for the International Food Policy Research Institute?
A variety of different funding sources. Probably the most important is from the major international aid agencies, the World Bank, USAID, the German Aid Agency. Those are organizations that contribute the most. Recently, we've been getting a lot of money from some private foundations. In particular, the Gates Foundation is a major source of funding in the last couple of years because. Right. They've decided to spend more money on agriculture in the developing world.
Good enough. When I ask Larry Matlack the question, is the globe warming? And if so, is man at fault?
Are you asking Larry? You're asking
I'm asking
now.
You.
Oh, me now.
Your turn.
My turn. Well, the answer...
Larry is, in essence, deferred to the experts, I think, which is you, so...
Okay, well, we should be clear that I'm an economist and not a climate scientist.
Okay.
And so what I am doing is looking at the impacts of potential impacts of climate change. Mm-hmm. I think there's a couple of factoids that's useful to know. There's really no question anymore that in the last 150 years or so, the average temperature at sea level has gone up about a half a degree Celsius. So that's about a degree or so Fahrenheit, which doesn't sound like very much. But the question really is, and even that amount has caused problems, you begin to see more effects at the northern and southern latitudes and in the high elevations, so like glaciers are tending to go away.
Right.
But the real issue is what's causing it and whether or not that's going to continue in the future. And there, the science is, I think, pretty definite that we are headed for more warming unless we do something about it.
Okay, so you're suggesting that man is at fault then?
Yes, I think there's no question that man is at fault.
Okay, just wanted to get the answer from how both of you see this particular world here. There.
All right.
Let's go to the real big question. How will climate change affect our ability to feed ourselves? Larry, let's start with you. You represent farmers in the Midwest. What's going to happen to them? Oops, there goes our sounder. That means that we have to take a quick break. But that's the question that we're going to pick up when we come back. How will global warming affect our ability to farm, to grow crops, to feed each other? What do you think? Phone numbers today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We have Larry Matlack, who is the president of the American Agricultural Movement, and we have also Gerald Nelson, who is the Senior Research Fellow for the International Food Policy Research Institute. Boy, that is a mouthful.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we have you. So pick up your phone and join us. What do you think? Who is going to pay to clean up farming's bad gas? Right? Is it going to be you? I bet it is. Right back, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. This is The Food Chain. I am Michael Olson.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, they say the earth is warming, and a big part of the reason is agriculture. It's how we grow our food. We're emitting too much greenhouse gas, and it's our fault. So what are we going to do about it? How are we going to clean it up? And in the process of cleaning up, who's going to pay for it? And what does it mean for our ability to grow food and process food? All of these are very, very big questions, and they span the world with their import. Today we're talking the big question is what happens to us when we try to clean up our mess with agriculture. We have with us Gerald Nelson, who is a senior research fellow with the International Food Policy Research Institute, and Larry Matlack, president of the American Agriculture Movement. So if the earth is warming, how will this climate change affect our ability to feed ourselves? Larry, are your farmers in the Midwest going to be growing bananas?
I don't think the change is going to be quite that extreme, but most models do show that there are going to be some dramatic changes in some parts of the world, and overall, I don't think that agriculture production necessarily benefits, even though some areas do, from the climate change models that are out there. But I think the thing that we need to understand, and I'm most familiar with the situation here in the U.S., worldwide, I'm sure there are many other dynamics that come into play that, of course, we all need to participate in and make better also. But in the U.S., agriculture in the U.S. only accounts for about 7% of the greenhouse gas emissions that are taking place by the most recent numbers that I've seen, and I think that depends on how far you carry back emissions that might actually be happening somewhere else, but they're attributing mm-hmm. it to our production because we might use the fertilizer that's made in Russia or whatever. But at any rate, agriculture, on the other hand, can actually mitigate somewhere between 25 and 28% of the total greenhouse gas emissions.
Well,
before
we get to that, I'd like to take us down through the road here, and that's of course how we want to end up is how can agriculture mitigate. But before we get there, I'd like to go to Gerald Nelson and ask him, you know, how will climate change affect our ability to feed ourselves? What will it mean for agriculture?
Well, you know, it obviously depends on where you are. If you happen to be in the Corn Belt in the U.S., you should be looking for Oklahoma-type weather for your grandkids, and California could get significantly drier. Of course, there are parts of Canada that will get better, and you could actually move the Corn Belt up there, but right now the soils are pretty bad for that kind of outcome. Generally, our research is suggesting that, you know, if we had no productivity change and we took the climate of 2050 and moved it back to today, we'd have 17% to 20% declines in yields.
Wow.
And that's into a world that's going to have 50% more people.
So, that's pretty...
not a trivial change.
That's a significant change.
Yep.
More people, less food.
Well, less yields unless we do something about it. I think that the cup half full is part of the story is that even with today's varieties, if you move them around, you can offset some of the effects because different varieties of crops have different responses to, you know, temperature and rainfall.
Well, let me ask you, let's start with you, Gerald. How did agriculture get so dirty?
Well, we're talking about soil, after all, that
uh-huh.
grow the plant.
There it is.
Agriculture, you know, contributes totally around the world about 15%. So it's actually larger contributions of greenhouse gases in the rest of the world than the United States. Part of it, a relatively small amount of it, comes from the fact that when you till the soil and you open up new areas to cultivation, which we're not doing in the U.S., but other parts of the world they are, you take the soil carbon and you release it into the atmosphere. That good black soil has got a bunch of carbon in it.
So how do you get the, what do you do? Just sit there and throw this dirt up into the air? How do you get the soil into the air?
Well, when you plow it, all of that good organic material turns back into CO2 and goes back into the sky. So one of the things you don't want to do is what you want to do is reduce the amount that you plow.
Okay.
So CO2 is part of the story, but the other part is methane, which comes out both the front and the back end of the cow, and also nitrous oxide, which is results from putting fertilizer onto crops, both organic and inorganic. Fertilizer results in nitrous oxide emissions. And the thing is that both those two are really much more powerful in terms of their greenhouse gas effects than carbon dioxide is.
So we're looking at two sources of greenhouse gases here. One is agriculture itself, wherein we plow the soil and take what's in the soil and throw it up into the sky. And the other is land use, where we convert land. I flew into the Amazon basin here a few years ago, and as far as you could see, there were smokes going up into the sky, which is to say people were chopping down the forest and burning the trees and making land available for agriculture. Is that what you're talking about?
That's actually an additional effect. The estimates for agriculture, which traditionally is defined as crops and things like that, 15%. If you include cutting down trees for a variety of things, both for fuel wood and for pasture and eventually for crops as well, that adds another 20%. So if you add those all up, you're getting up to the 30% of total emissions range.
Which is hugely significant then.
Hugely significant, right.
There's a difference between the greenhouse gases being emitted by developed nations and by developing nations, correct?
That's right.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, in the developed world, think of the U.S., for example, we basically have not changed our forests. In fact, our forests are growing back relative to where they were 20, 30, 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So we're taking carbon dioxide out of the air and turning it into wood in our forests. That's on the agriculture side. On the non-agriculture side, of course, we drive cars like crazy and
right.
we use coal to generate electricity. Less of that in the developing world, although that's changing as income grows, particularly in China and India.
Mm-hmm. So what about the emissions of the developing world?
The emissions of the developing world are still small in total relative to the developed world. But the mix is different. A lot more from agriculture, an awful lot from deforestation.
Mm-hmm.
So when we think about controlling greenhouse gases, we need to have different solutions for different parts of the world.
So
in the United States, you know, we've got to figure out how to reduce our use of carbon-based energy sources, coal and fossil fuels. In the developing world, it's much more focused today on agriculture and deforestation.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you don't want them to go down the path that we've gone down, which is
to use
a lot of carbon.
To use more carbon. You know, understand that I did a program some time ago, and we talked about how people in the developing sections of the world use plant matter and animal dung for cooking fuel.
That's right.
And it's a huge percentage of the world's population actually burns. So that's what you're talking about with respect to the pollution in the developing world as opposed to that of the developed world, right?
That's right. Although that particular pollution is a recycled. You know, the plant material gets burned, gets turned into carbon dioxide, but then the plants, assuming we use them right, take the carbon dioxide out of the air and turn it back into plant material.
So that's recyclable then?
Yeah, there's a difference between sort of recycled carbon and fossil carbon. So the stuff that you're getting from coal and from oil was put into the ground millions and millions of years ago and taken out of the atmosphere.
And that can't be recycled?
Well, it can be recycled into plants, and it can be recycled, at least in an experimental way, deep into the ground with what's called carbon capture and storage. So basically you take the gas that comes out of the top of a coal-fired plant and you pump it, you know, a couple of miles down into the ground under great pressure, and then you hope that it stays there.
Wow. And that actually works?
Well, there's no commercial plant in the world that does this.
That does that. So this is pure theory then.
Yeah, there's some experimental work on this. And the Bush administration stopped. I used to come from Illinois, and right outside my town, there was a plan to put a plant to actually do that, the first sort of commercial plant. But it was stopped at the end of the Bush administration. And I'm not sure. I think the Obama administration has begun to reconsider that decision. But in any case, it's a long ways out in the future in terms of being a commercially viable way to get out.
So for all practical purposes, it remains in theory and not in practice. And
that's correct.
Okay, folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Who is going to pay to clean up farming's bad gas? It's warming up our world and putting pressure on our ability to grow our own food. So who's going to pay to clean it up? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Agriculture, they say, accounts for too much greenhouse gas and must be reformed. And this leads us to ask, who is going to pay to clean up farming's bad gas? That's the question of the day, and we've got Gerald Nelson, who's a senior research fellow with the International Food Policy Research Institute, and Larry Matlack, president of the American Agriculture Movement, and we're searching for an answer to those very big questions today. So how do we go about reforming agriculture? How do we go about, you know, changing the goose that laid the golden egg without destroying it? Larry, you seem to be brimming with an answer. So let's go to you, Larry Matlack.
Well, there are a couple of things that we need to, you know, put in perspective a little bit. For one thing, you know, we talked about 7% of the greenhouse gases coming from agriculture here in the U.S., 15% worldwide. If we took only 10% of the world's pasture land and we were producing an energy crop on that pasture land that was yielding 20 tons per acre and converting it at the 100-gallon per ton rate into ethanol, it would replace 100% of the world's need for petroleum.
So we're talking about biomass ethanol, right?
We're talking about biomass ethanol. Now, mm-hmm. On the other hand, we also need to understand that there are a lot of parts to where the greenhouse emissions are coming from. We have nearly a billion tons of agriculture residues that are decaying into the atmosphere every year, and those tons of biomass are producing methane and CO2. And contributing to the global warming.
Bad gas, right?
Right. Now, we have a tremendous opportunity with that excess crop residue that is there to remove that residue and use it to directly replace fossil fuel usage, coal usage, petroleum usage, natural gas usage.
So, again, we're talking about biomass ethanol.
Well, no. You could use it direct heat and power. You could produce electricity with it. You could do anything.
You mean by burning it?
By gasifying or clean burning. In other words, you know, control burning has to be done in a way that you don't create another pollutant or a pollutant that's just as bad. I mean, you've got to have a system
that works well. But anyway, that's a tremendous opportunity to do that. Now, at the same time, we have to protect our soils and improve our soil's quality, and that generally means the carbon content of that soil.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, it becomes important that we take care of that soil in some fashion. Well, every crop that's growing out there is pulling carbon out of the atmosphere, and it's putting a portion of that carbon into the soils, and it's putting a portion of that carbon into the residue that ends up on top of the ground.
Is that what they call carbon sequestering?
Yes, that's technically, and some crops are better at it than others
mm-hmm.
are. So consequently,
we're taking the bad stuff out of the air and putting it back into the soil.
Putting it back mm-hmm. into the soil.
And
the only negative is that crop residue that then contributes back into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you remove that residue, and in the areas where you have adequate rainfall, which is quite a portion of the farming land in the United States, you plant a cover crop. Now, carbon sequestration from a crop standpoint becomes a year-round function as opposed to only seasonal, and you displaced all of the fossil carbon with the residue you removed, and you improved the soil because you were sequestering that carbon year-round with that cover crop. Now, you ask who's going to pay. There certainly has to be a profit in all of that for agriculture to do that.
Right.
But in the end, it actually produces a better environment for everyone, and we're paying today for the pollution, of course, that is being caused.
Yep. Gerald Nelson, does that make sense to you?
Well, excuse me. I'm not a big fan of biofuels, ethanol in particular, the way we currently do it.
Well, that would be...
Corn in the United States.
Yeah, that would be essentially fruit ethanol when it gets right down to it. Right?
Yeah, you know, and the problem with that is that, you know, if you think about this biofuel stuff, really basically what you're doing is trying to figure out how to capture sunlight, right?
And sure, always. That's always the essence of everything.
And so, you know, the question is whether that's the best way to use solar energy. It's possible that the cellulosic ethanol that we're working on might be more efficient than the current corn-based technology. But it's also been the case that proponents of that have claimed it's going to be available commercially for the last 15 years.
Sure.
And still working
next year for the last 15 years.
So, you know, I don't want anybody to hold their breath and think that ethanol or biofuels is going to solve this particular problem. We need to think about the best way to get a hold of solar energy and put it to use for transportation and for, you know, heating and all those sorts of things.
Okay, what's your solution then?
Well, I think, you know, the point that Larry made about soil carbon is a really important point, and I think I want to emphasize that. There's a lot of places in the world, and the U.S. is not one of them, actually, but there are a lot of places in the world where, with some better farming practices, we can put a lot more carbon into the soil. I'll get that straight one of these
uh-huh.
times. And on top of that, we'll improve the crop productivity.
Are we talking like doing some very simple things like mulching and composting and things like that?
We're talking about doing things like not plowing as much. It turns out that there's many places in the world where you don't need to plow as much as farmers are actually plowing mm-hmm. in order to get better yields. And we're talking about using actually more fertilizers of various kinds, composting, inorganic fertilizers. All of those things eventually create, used done properly, give you more carbon in the soil, more soil mm-hmm. organic material, which is both good for the crops and good for the reducing greenhouse gas.
So it seems like what you're saying, both of you, is that those technologies that have been put forth by the organic food industry, like composting and recycling, are making sense, seem to make sense from a greenhouse gas emission perspective. Seems like that's the better way to do it. Am I wrong?
Larry, you want to respond, or shall I?
Well, I was going to say, I think that we have seen a lot of models that show that agriculture is the most economical way to address the greenhouse gases, and that we can do things better with no-till farming practices. Work extremely well, which is another reason we can utilize those crop residues so well, because once you plant a cover crop to address wind and water erosion and the protection of the land, you're also improving that carbon and sequestering more. So,
Larry,
you know, it's a win-win for everybody.
Yeah, Larry, would you describe the no-till that you're talking about for city people who have never seen a plow?
Well, in other words, there are a number of different systems out there where we're using specialized equipment that either works with all of the residue that's there.
Does it work with the residue that's there? What does it do?
It cuts it, slices it, parts it. It's a much heavier, much more expensive tool to do that, so that plowing is not required.
So it kind of chops it up and leaves it on the top of the soil then?
Yes, or rakes it away mm-hmm. slightly. I mean, there's different ways that it's done with different pieces of equipment, but it disturbs the soil much less, so you have much less carbon exposure and much less than, of course, CO2 going into the atmosphere. No-till tries to do, but there are some real drawbacks to it of diseases and other things that are caused many times by an excess of material on top of the soil.
Also
causes increased application of nitrogen fertilizer because it takes nitrogen to break down crop residue there. So there's a lot of things going on, and it's different everywhere. I mean, there is no magic bullet that's the same across the country. I mean, every farm is unique and every soil type is unique, and our conservation practices have to take that into account.
That's what we're going to address when we get back. Folks, this is the Food Chain. What on earth can we do to improve the greenhouse gas emissions of our agriculture? 800-624-2665, 831-4792. Right back. Welcome back. This is the Food Chain. Who is going to pay to clean up farming's bad gas? Almost 14% of the greenhouse gases, our annual greenhouse gases emitted here on Earth, come from agriculture. What can we do to slow that down, to make our agriculture cleaner, to more friendly to our sky, what's up there and protecting us? So it's interesting that if we're really careful here in the developed world, we can take care of these technologies that perhaps you expose less of our carbon to the air and hold it in the ground where we really need it. And it seems to me like much of the technologies there are coming out of the organic world, where you try to recycle as much as possible. You take all of your crop residues, you compost it, you turn it into rich humus, and you put it back into the soil, and that humus holds things into the soil, and instead of allowing them to escape back into the atmosphere, seems like that's kind of the way to go. But let's check in with Bob, who's got a phone call today, talking about carbon cycling in India, I believe. Bob, welcome to the Food Chain.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about pastoral agriculture and carbon cycling running herds of animals over perennial deep-rooted grasses, much like wild herds did in our past, and contrasting that with the confined animal feeding operations where, well, for example, beef cattle are held in pens and tractors burning diesel are running up and down fields growing corn and soybeans, and trucks are transporting it to them. And these animals are eating this and getting sick and having to be fed lots of sodium bicarbonate, mm-hmm. so they can belch properly. Whereas the animals out on pasture don't have this problem with the large amounts of emissions.
You know, Bob, I had several people email me the same comment. They said essentially that animals in confined feedlots fart a lot, and animals out grazing on grass don't.
Well, if they do, they're very discreet about it. Because I haven't seen it with my cows on the pasture.
Well, you would probably know if you're following them around, you know.
Yes, indeed. Uh-huh. And with the land that I started converting back to pasture from berry farming had a very low percentage of carbon in the top 8 inches of topsoil, and it's growing every year, not just in the top 8 inches, but below that
mm-hmm.
as well. And there's been a lot of advances in the science of grazing in the past few decades, and the rotational grazing is very much in favor now, where the grass is just practically, it looks like it's destroyed by the herd going through, but
Well, I'm going to pick up, well, I lost him there, but I'm going to pick up Larry Matlack. Larry, did what he said make any sense? Is that what you're talking about, changing the way we do agriculture here in the United States?
Well, I'm not saying there can't be some improvements, I guess, but we want to remember that's probably a pretty small portion of what's going on. Those animals primarily are on pasture for more than a year before they spend 120 days in a feedlot somewhere right. in a confined system. Also, I think that there's some research that shows if you're actually using distiller's grains after you have removed the starch to have the ethanol, that right. then you actually have less gas emissions and you also have better meat conversion, so that, in fact, the ethanol, in essence, becomes free in the environmental sense of doing this, because we really improved the system. But and you can ship feed much. The world's short of protein, not short of starches.
Yep.
And it costs less to ship the protein from a distiller's grain leftovers than it does to ship the whole grain to the world that's hungry. So there's a lot of benefits to ethanol production sometimes that we overlook.
Okay. Let me go to Gerald Nelson. What about the developing world? What can we do to make the developing world more efficient with respect to greenhouse gases?
Well, I would let me just take in a couple of comments about that.
Please
last
do.
Phone call. You know, I think the issue of carbon in the soil and pastures is a very important one. You know, if you get these grasses that have these long roots, then that's the carbon goes down deep into the soil rather than staying close to the top or eventually ending up in the atmosphere. And in terms of the animals running around on the grass and farting, well, there's actually two sources of methane. One of them is it comes out of the rumen, so out of the front end of the animal, and mm-hmm. the other one is the methane that comes out of the decomposition of the animal's waste. And if that's going to occur regardless of whether you have the animal in the feedlot or whether you have it out in the field, except that you're more likely to get concentrated emissions in the feedlot, which you can then capture. And there are captures.
Let me picture this. You have a large dome over the feedlot, right?
Exactly.
So, really?
Yeah. You've got that in. You've got some of that going on in the Central Valley of California right now.
Wow.
And the gas that's emitted, the methane gas, actually, you know, is used to generate heat and powers the operation. We're
okay.
not going to do that in the developing world, by the way, at least not anytime soon.
Okay, we're going to have to take a quick break for when we come back with the final question: who will pay to patch up this problem we're having with agriculture's bad gas? Is this situation going to be like that suggested in the Kyoto protocols, in which the rich nations will be asked to foot the bill for the poor nations? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. This is The Food Chain. Right back after these important messages. Do stay tuned. Well, agriculture, they say, is responsible for too much greenhouse gas, and it must be reformed. So my question is, who's going to pay? It seems like here in the developed world, we have a pretty good handle on what's going on, and we can get a hold of situations, and we can pass laws to get control and force each other to reduce our greenhouse emissions. But what about in the developing world, where people essentially are burning camel dung to cook their food? How do we get a hold of that situation, and who is going to pay for it? That's my question. Is this a Kyoto Protocols kind of situation where we're going to force the developed world to foot the bill, as it were, for the developing nations? That's my question, and we'll start with Gerald. Gerald, who's going to pay for all of this?
Well, this is my personal opinion. We don't know for sure because the negotiations aren't done, but my personal opinion is that we should, you and me and people in the developed world. Partly it's just a matter of fairness. We've put most of the carbon into the atmosphere, and so we should help get it out. Partly it's a matter of it's just tough to do that in the developing world unless we provide them some incentives.
It seems to me like all of the rules that we pass here in the United States to make our country a cleaner world, in effect, encourage producers to go away to another country. And so we end up Going down to the, we chase all of our industry away. We go down to the big box store and we buy made in China, which is from the dirtiest country on earth. Are we really doing what we're trying to do?
You know, the land isn't going to go anywhere in the United States. What we need to do is to quit using it in particular ways that emit greenhouse gases. We don't want to charge for food production. We want to charge for greenhouse gas emissions. And if you charge, everybody knows that we'll quit doing the stuff that we shouldn't be doing. Well, we'll continue to supply food.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody needs food. We're going to continue to need food. And the land isn't going anywhere.
Larry Matlack, if we start charging for carbon emissions, will all production go offshore? Will we be eating food that comes out of a Chinese factory of some kind?
I think if it's done in the right way, we'll end up with incentives that actually create a renaissance in rural America, because it will take more people. If we're going to harvest the full potential. Remember, agriculture is only working at about 3% of its capacity now in this country. 97% of all farm income comes from off the farm. So we have the potential to do much more, and we can be in the energy business and in the food production business and do a lot for greenhouse gas emissions. And in doing that, we're going to develop technologies that's going to make it easier for the developing world to never go down the road as dirty as we have, and that's going to improve the situation for everyone.
So you're saying that agriculture is going to get in on this, the business of sequestering carbon, and make a lot of money?
I think we have, well, I don't know about a lot of money, but we have the ability to do the job, and it does cost something because we're gaining something. Remember, we eat in this country the greatest foods in the greatest prepared way at by far the lowest cost of anywhere on the face of the earth. And that all came about because that was our purpose and there was a profit in it. We can do the same thing in the field of energy and greenhouse gas emissions. We are that capable. We are that innovative in this country.
Well, Larry Matlack, Gerald Nelson, thank you both for joining us today on the Food Chain. Really appreciate it. Sorry out there for those who I couldn't get to today. You can always join us on the discussion page on the forums at metroforum.com. The question of the day, can we clean up agriculture without killing the goose that laid the golden egg? You can hear a recording of this broadcast at metroforum.com, and hope to see you all next week for more What's Eating What Radio. Now remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.